Your Excellency Sharon Hudson-Dean, U.S. Consul General, Jim Caruso, former acting U.S. Ambassador, now Senior Foreign Policy Advisor to U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, members of the Lowy Institute, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this very special event with the Commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Philip Davidson. U.S. Indo-Pacific Command is a very interesting entity. It's one of the half a dozen, I think, geographic combatant commands that within the U.S. military that reports to the President through the Secretary of Defense. It was established in 1947 at the beginning of this sort of golden period of U.S. dominance in our part of the world. And it's one of the oldest, it's the oldest, I think, and the largest of the U.S. unified commands. Many fine officers have held the Admiral's position before he did. Of course, Harry Harris was a friend of the Institute and spoke here on a couple of occasions. It was one fewer occasion than we wanted because I can let you in on a little secret, and that is that 2 years ago, we wanted to invite Harry to give a major speech to the Lowy Institute, and after he'd been nominated to serve as ambassador to Australia. So I flew up to Indo-PACOM and I went to Honolulu, and Harry hosted a lovely lunch with his general officers in your dining room there, and we discussed the details and we shook on it. And I remember sending an email to my colleagues and to my board saying, terrific, Ambassador Harris is going to give his first major speech to the Lowy Institute. And I flew back to Australia and I woke up the next day and I heard on the radio that Harry Harris's nomination as ambassador to Australia had been withdrawn and he was being sent to South Korea instead.
No one was more surprised than Harry.
Well, there was one person more surprised than Harry, and that was me. It's interesting times in Washington, Admiral, and military officers like Harry Harris and you have to roll with the punches and get on with the job. Ladies and gentlemen, PACOM Pacific Command was rebadged as Indo-Pacific Command in May 2018, and Admiral Harris is the 25th officer.
Davidson.
I beg your pardon. Admiral Davidson is the 25th officer to hold that office. In his role, he's responsible for military operations in an area that stretches from the waters off the west coast of the United States to the west coast of India, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, over 200 million square kilometres and more than half the world's surface. He is a surface warfare officer who's deployed across the globe in frigates, destroyers, cruisers, and aircraft carriers. He's held a number of important offices. He's a graduate of the US Naval War College and the Naval Academy, and he assumed command of US Indo-Pacific Command in May 2018. Admiral, you're arriving at Australia at a sort of Old Testament moment with fires and droughts and floods and pestilence. So we're looking forward to some reassurance from the US Indo-Pacific Commander. Let me invite the Admiral to the lectern. He's going to talk to us for about 20 minutes and then he'll join me on stage for a Q&A session. Admiral, the lectern is yours. Welcome, sir.
Aloha. The response in Hawaii whenever we say that is aloha, aloha. Aloha. And good day. And now I've gotten the whole extent of my second and third languages on the table, so you have that. Michael, thank you for the introduction. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the insights on Admiral Harris as well. Before I go any farther, speaking of the challenges here in Australia, on behalf of my entire team, headquarters, and indeed across the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command area responsibility, all the military folks in it, I'd like to begin by offering our deepest condolences for all those lost here in the devastating bushfires in Australia. We are also very grateful for the empathy given to the families of those brave Americans who were lost helping to battle those fires as well. They were veterans all, and the families noted the special embrace that Australia gave them. There is certainly a scar in the landscape, and I think a scar in everyone's hearts for those that were lost across Indo-PACOM, so our condolences. The United States remains committed to providing to the people of Australia in the ongoing relief efforts across the region as well. In fact, that was General Campbell, the Chief of the Defense Forces, and I spoke a couple of times right around the New Year, and I reaffirmed that here this week. And I bring that up because I want to note it more than anything else. This is what friends and allies are for. The United States will always be here to support you, just as you have always been there to do the same for us. We take great pride in the fact that our troops have fought side by side in every major military conflict over the last century, beginning with the First World War. Indeed, the United States has no better friend than Australia, and I would add that Australia has no better friend than the United States. This year, we celebrate the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. Together, Australian and American men and women fought during Guadalcanal, Coral Sea, and the Battle of Darwin, pushing back enemy advances and preventing an invasion of the Australian continent. The Battle of Darwin, whose anniversary falls just next week, a week from today, in fact, February 19th, 1942, was the largest single attack on Australia in history, with over 260 enemy aircraft. Our Allied forces suffered the loss of 16 airmen, 9 of them were Americans, and 88 United States ship Percy sailors, the only ship lost during that battle. Aussies and Americans fought as one to set others free. It was the crucible that formed our bond, that built trust and confidence in our friendship and led to our mutual defense treaty. Our unbreakable alliance is an anchor for peace and security in the region and around the globe. It runs deeper than security cooperation or our military-to-military ties. We share a common language, more or less, a common set of values, I like to think, and a deep and abiding respect for liberty. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to meet with Prime Minister Morrison, Foreign Minister Payne, and Defense Minister Reynolds in Canberra. The resounding theme throughout the dialogue was the fundamental belief that we are stronger together and we are going to work together. And just like Darwin in 1942, the United States is all in the Indo-Pacific, where the stakes could not possibly be any higher. In fact, the United States is not bluffing. We are certainly not folding. We are doubling down on our bets here in the Indo-Pacific, and we're looking to guarantee the payout. Allow me to deal out a few examples of our commitment here in the Indo-Pacific, announced relatively recently, just the last few years. First, the United States' reassurance to the people of Japan in 2014 that an attack on the Senkaku Islands would invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty, honoring our 60-plus year commitment to the people of Japan. This stands as a clear pledge to our Japanese ally and to the region that our bonds to the Indo-Pacific are only growing stronger. Second, U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo's reaffirmation less than 1 year ago that any armed attack on Philippine sovereign entities in the South China Sea would trigger our mutual defense obligations. His promise underscores our strong security partnership with the Philippines and serves as a beacon of peace and stability in the face of increased aggression in the region, especially by PRC military forces in the South China Sea. Number three, in September of last year, the United States and Singapore renewed our longstanding memorandum of understanding, extending U.S. use of defense-related facilities and logistics support as provided by Singapore. The memorandum of understanding, as announced by President Trump and the Prime Minister of Singapore, highlights the deep security ties between the United States and Singapore and the guarantees that our long-term presence means in the gateway of the Indo-Pacific. Number four, Secretary Pompeo's announcement last August that the United States would expand our agreements with the freely associated states of Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and reopen negotiations to build on a growing economic relationship. That was prefaced by the historic inaugural meeting between all three presidents of the freely associated states and President Trump in Washington last May. That signified U.S. resolve and our close cooperation and support for these nations. Such a meeting had never occurred in history before. Number five, the United States' deep cooperation with the Pacific Island nations and commitment to supply dedicated resources, develop capabilities, enhance capacity building, and provide advanced training. Last year, the United States pledged more than $100 million U.S. dollars in new assistance to the Pacific Islands alone, on top of the approximately $350 million that U.S. agencies already invest annually to build a more prosperous future for the region's people. Lastly, the affirmation repeatedly made by the last three U.S. Secretaries of Defense, including Secretary Esper just this month, that the Indo-Pacific is the priority theater for the United States. And I could go on. Each of these steps exemplifies our deep, enduring, and growing commitment to the region. Indeed, we are betting on a free and open future together alongside our allies and partners here in the Indo-Pacific. It is this commitment that provides the cornerstone of our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific. There are many in the region who share that vision, including Australia, Japan, New Zealand, India, the United Kingdom, France, and Canada. Even ASEAN, under the leadership of Indonesia's initiative, has put forth a vision for a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific. The United States Indo-Pacific strategy is very much a whole-of-nation approach and is rooted in the values that have underpinned peace and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific for decades. Michael highlighted it as the last 70 years, a golden era. It is centered on the idea that free societies respect individual rights and liberties, the promotion of good governance, and adherence to the shared values of the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It means free nations do not have to choose with whom they partner with or trade with out of fear or coercion. Instead, these nations are free to exercise their sovereignty, fundamentally their choice. The idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific affirms that all nations should enjoy unfettered, open access to the seas and airways upon which our people and economies depend. This openness also applies to the cyberspace and space domains, which provide critical avenues for future global prosperity and should be dictated by a rule of norms we all agree to. According to shared principles, nations are able to have open investment environments, transparent agreements with one another, protection of intellectual property rights, and fair and reciprocal trade. After all, the Indian and Pacific Oceans do not separate us. The vastness of the seas are not borders. They are not boundaries. They are what bind us all together, bringing mutual benefits and growth and shared success. Despite the many cultural differences across the Indo-Pacific, our principled values, our collective interests, and our mutual security concerns will drive us forward. This is how the U.S. has approached the Indo-Pacific region throughout our 240-plus year history, and we remain rooted in these principles moving forward. And you all know, as well as I, that we, all of the nations of the Indo-Pacific, are in a strategic competition within this region. This is a competition between a Beijing-centric order and a free and open Indo-Pacific. After all, the Communist Party of China is actively seeking to supplant the established rules-based international order, to dictate new international norms and behaviors, and new relationships to the region. Indeed, this very public goal is to establish norms driven, guided, and enforced by the party in Beijing. Beijing's approach is pernicious. The party uses coercion, influence operations, and military and diplomatic threats to bully other states to accommodate the Communist Party of China's interests. These actions often directly threaten the sovereignty of other nations and undermine regional stability. In pursuit of their vision, the Communist Party of China employs a whole-of-government approach using political, economic, and military tools, as well as a vast propaganda machine to garner the support and influence necessary to reshape relationships and gain accesses in the region that are more favorable to the party's interests. The Communist Party of China is looking to change the world order to one where Chinese national power is more important than international law, a system where the strong do what they will and the weak do what they must. Through excessive territorial claims, debt trap diplomacy, violations of international agreements, theft of intellectual property, military intimidation, and outright corruption, the Communist Party of China seeks to control the flow of trade, finance, communications, politics, and the way of life throughout the Indo-Pacific, where nearly two-thirds of the world's population will live in 15 years. Countries that establish closer ties to the Communist Party of China with the expectation that the move will stimulate economic growth and infrastructure development often find themselves worse off in the end. The good news here in the Indo-Pacific is that much of the Indo-Pacific is now wise to these methods, and friends and partners to the United States and indeed to Australia are now frequently calling for advice when it comes to dealing with the Communist Party of China's entreaties. These calls were far less frequent 5 years ago. I am encouraged now that the principled values, converging interests, and the mutual concerns for our liberty are resonating across the Indo-Pacific. Let me be clear about the United States posture. The U.S. does not seek conflict with China, nor do we seek to decouple our economy with China. Those are Chinese talking points. Furthermore, the United States has no intention or desire to restrain Chinese economic growth or prosperity. Our global economy is deeply intertwined, and we, like Australia, understand the importance of a global market. With that in mind, the global economy must respect sovereignty and the rule of law, use responsible business practices, and operate with transparency. I've traveled throughout the region to meet with political and military leaders, as well as those in business, and many believe they are being forced to choose between economic prosperity and relations with China or a secure partnership with the United States. Let me assure you that our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific recognizes the linkages between the economy and security. They are part of the competitive landscape throughout the region. Inclusiveness for all is fundamental to the idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific. And over the last 70 years, it has resulted in the remarkable regional economic development enjoyed today. It has literally lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. Indeed, China is one of those economies that has benefited from that approach to the region. The global community wants to see a vibrant, economically strong China that honors its international agreements and is a responsible stakeholder in the rules-based international order. But as the Communist Party of China's malign influence expands globally, I want to be clear that the alliance between the United States and Australia will be even more critical. Indeed, the United States has deep ties with Australia that highlight our shared values and our commitment to enduring friendships and to bolstering prosperity in the region. It is the main reason I am here in Australia this week. The United States, as is Australia, is committed to deepening the people-to-people ties, enhancing our security cooperation and infrastructure development, and enabling private sector-led economic development in the region. We continue to expand our support to regional security by broadening our military exercises, increasing the number of U.S. defense attachés in the Pacific Island chain, and increasing our United States National Guard state partnership programs in the Indo-Pacific. We are working closely with Australia to make sure our efforts are complementary throughout the region, as evidenced by specific cooperative efforts mentioned before in Fiji and Papua New Guinea. Australia and the United States enjoy the benefits associated with information sharing at the highest levels as the Five Eye partners that we are. And this past October, defense officials from Australia, from Japan, and the United States met in Hawaii to sign a trilateral information sharing agreement, or TISA. The TISA will further enhance the strategic trilateral relationship and support peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific through our own rapid information sharing and to enable higher capability, better defense exercises, and more integrated operations amongst our three nations. We are encouraged by and support Australia's direct commitments to the Pacific Island nations as well. I'll mention just one briefly, the recently completed Coral Sea cable system. This submarine fiber optic cable system links Australia to the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, a game-changing advance in technology designed to improve access to critical information for our partners in the region. I must also commend Australia for heavily investing in the Pacific Fusion Center, an Australian government-funded analytical center supporting Pacific Island Forum members. The Pacific Fusion Center will help raise the awareness and collectively combat challenges in the region, like illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, and human and narcotics trafficking. Like Australia, the United States remains committed to providing dedicated resources, developing capabilities, and training personnel in support of current and future security challenges facing the Pacific Islands. We are here to help on the Pacific Fusion Center and look forward to working with Australia. I mentioned that I had met with General Campbell earlier this week. We continue to advance our relationship with the Australian Defence Force on multiple levels. This year marks the 9th consecutive iteration of the Marine Rotational Force Darwin, or MRFD, as we call it, an initiative designed to develop enhanced interoperability, our capacity, and our warfighting capability for combined and joint operations between Australia and the United States. The MRFD enables U.S. Marines and the Australian Defense Forces to effectively train, exercise, and operate with allies and partners to enhance regional security and capacity building through the rotation of a full Marine air ground task force of up to 2,500 U.S. Marines. Our force posture initiatives also include the Enhanced Air Cooperation, the EAC, which incorporates fifth-generation aircraft integration and joint bomber activities. The EAC improves our interoperability and expands aviation capabilities between our two air forces in Australia and the United States. Shifting from these initiatives to exercises, Exercise Talisman Sabre stands as one of the premier military exercises in the region and has been increasing in complexity, size, and scope during each iteration, and we talked about advancing it just this week. The joint biennial exercise between our two nations involves more than 33,000 personnel and demonstrates our dedication to improving combined operations and improving our combat readiness. The exercise, Talisman Sabre, again, reflects the closeness of our alliance and the strength of our enduring military relationship. I would be remiss if I did not mention our strong economic bonds. These include a bilateral investment of more than $1 trillion between our two nations. Each year, Australia spends roughly $480 billion U.S. dollars in the United States, which equals approximately one quarter of Australia's total outbound investment. Australians also invest heavily in the U.S. education sector, as the United States is the largest destination for Aussies studying abroad. The United States, in turn, is Australia's largest foreign investor, with over $630 billion U.S. dollars in accumulated investment here in Australia. Foreign direct investment is inherently enduring and speaks to the depth of our relationship and our collective opportunity and security. The United States invests heavily in the Australian technology market as well, in defense, in aerospace, in space, and in biotechnologies. U.S. research and development investments in the Australian market total more than $670 million annually and focus on the pharmaceutical, medical, and high-tech industries that I mentioned, and these show no signs of slowing down in the future. And I must say that we look towards Australia as a leader in developing frontier technologies and working with Australia on things as quantums, robotics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. As I look out towards the region more widely, our U.S. economic investments include the U.S. Build, the Better Utilization of Investment Leading to Development Act, which created the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation. These developments address the infrastructure challenges necessary for sustained economic growth and development in the region and unleashing the strength of private enterprise. The Build Act has the potential to be the key difference maker in terms of our United States whole of government strategic investment. I'm encouraged this week there are representatives from the White House and the Development Finance Corporation here talking with Australia and other like-minded nations about infrastructure development within the Pacific Island chain and across Southeast Asia. I should mention also the Blue Dot Network. That's a multi-stakeholder initiative spearheaded by Australia, Japan, and the United States, designed to bring together like-minded governments, the private sector, and civil society under shared values to advance global infrastructure development. This very inclusive network will evaluate infrastructure development projects around the globe on high standards like transparency, financial viability, and environmental sustainability. The Blue Dot Seal of Approval will confirm quality infrastructure development and adherence to global best practices in order to combat more corrupt approaches to infrastructure investment that undermine the prosperity for all of us. And I should add that Blue Dot projects respect the rule of law, build local capacity, ensure debt sustainability, and meet high labor standards to address the region's growing infrastructure demands. And we encourage all nations to join Australia and the United States in this initiative. I believe the economic interests of the Indo-Pacific region are converging. As a vast majority of nations support a globalized economy and understand that the way of the future is here in the Indo-Pacific. These economic relationships are rooted and must be rooted in the principles that provide protection of our intellectual property, that ensure free trade on a level playing field, and offer protection to labor and the environment. Our collective economic stability is a key anchor of strength, and access to U.S. markets and capital have been a pillar of peace and security throughout the Indo-Pacific. Our mutual security interests are key to stabilizing the environment for this business investment, both near and long term, through our widespread security engagement, our operations, and our capacity building efforts in the region as well. Our goal is to help enable all the countries of this region to be able to be full participants in a transparent global economy, able to trade and invest freely and competitively with whomever they want. And to ensure this outcome, the United States will continue to commit its resources, and I talked about some in the military domain, in the economic domain, in the diplomatic domain, certainly in education. This will be to the benefit of all of the Indo-Pacific, to the United States, Australia, and the region widely. I will end with one final anecdote that should hit home. In recent years, the Communist Party of China has at various points slowed or banned Australian exports going through Chinese ports. Beijing has shown a willingness to intervene in free markets and to hurt Australian companies simply because the Australian government has exercised its sovereign right to protect its national security. The episode that I speak to shows how the Communist Party of China uses its economic advantages to force other governments to reverse positions towards agreements that benefit China. It stands as just one of the countless examples of the pernicious way in which China conducts business and tries to coerce outcomes across the region. I am optimistic that the region is not only waking up to that aggressive behavior, but more importantly, beginning to take a stand against it. Indeed, together, we must position our alliance for the next century, as we cannot simply rely on our shared history. Our interconnected future will be based on a set of principles, backed by a diplomatic effort, backed by economic investment, backed by a combat-credible deterrent provided by the U.S., Australia, and a strong network of allies and partners here in this region. The United States stands by our allies, and we stand by our like-minded partners in the Indo-Pacific. We do so in competition, in crisis, and as history has proven over the past 100 years, in conflict as well. I said it at the beginning, and I'll say it again. Australia has no better friend than the United States, and the United States absolutely has no better friend than Australia. So I thank you for your time today and for your interest in the Indo-Pacific. It is indeed the most critical region on the planet, and it will continue to be so in the century ahead of us. May God bless all of you. May God bless the Commonwealth of Australia, the United States, and may God bless centuries of mateship to come. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Admiral. And let me start by saying thank you for the condolences that you offered for the Australians who lost their lives in the bushfires. And let me also pass on our condolences for those magnificent American firefighters you mentioned who flew halfway around the world to protect Australia from the fires. So thank you for that. You made some very direct comments, I thought, and I'd like to take you, we've got about half an hour, a bit less than half an hour before the end of the event. I'm going to ask questions of the Admiral for about half of that time, and then I'm going to offer the audience an opportunity to ask questions. So start thinking now. All right. I want to try in my period to ask you a couple of questions about the United States, mm-hmm. a couple of questions about China, and a couple of questions about Australia, if I can. First of all, on the United States, you talked about doubling down You said we're all in. You repeated the comment that various defence secretaries have made that the Indo-Pacific is the priority theatre for the United States. But there's been a lot of commentary in the last few days about the White House budget that came out this week and about whether whether your theatre had really received all the resources it needed compared to theatres in Europe and the Middle East. So I guess I'd ask you, Admiral, do you feel you're getting the dollars and the ships that you need from Washington to do what you need to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, as a global competitor and with the threats that are existing, not just in the Indo-Pacific, but across the globe, I would say that the United States has a deep and abiding interest in preventing Russian malign influence in Europe and in NATO and indeed across the whole of the globe, continuing to help counter violent extremist activity across the region, denying North Korea nuclear weapons, denying Iran a path to nuclear weapons as well. You know, that requires a broad portfolio of investments. I've certainly made the requirements of the Indo-Pacific Command known to my leadership in Washington. They're very supportive. They're supportive by their comments. And I appreciate the investments that I've made so far this year. I made light of the fact in a smaller session yesterday that, you know, what commander has come forward and said, you know, less would be acceptable. It doesn't really happen. I'll continue to advocate for resources here in the Indo-Pacific and keep the press on. But it's clear to me in all my conversations with the American people, particularly on Capitol Hill and across the executive department as well, that the Indo-Pacific remains the focus of our efforts going forward, and there are many more budgets to come.
Can I ask you, I would never ask you to criticize your own government, but do you find in your relations with other with Asian governments, do you find yourself spending a lot of time reassuring US allies that even if individual politicians don't appear to believe in alliances, this is still at the center of the US approach to the region?
You know, assurance is a key part of any deterrence strategy. I can say that the depth and direction of the five alliances that the United States holds here in the Indo-Pacific, the way in which we're advancing, and it's varying degrees between the different countries, depending on the depth of our commitments, is advancing our conversation and our transparency in a way that I think all of my allies understand the depth of our commitment.
Let me ask you about China. You had some pretty tough words about China, about the party state, about the Communist Party. You talked about its malign intentions, its pernicious activities. There's a lot of interest around the world in the Australian approach to China. And we've seen here in the past couple of years that, in particular, I think, driven by some impressive scoops by investigative journalists that have thrown sunlight on some of the activities of the party state that has really affected the debate, the political debate. It's affected public opinion, certainly, and it's affected policies in relation to the foreign influence transparency scheme and so on. How would you characterise Australia's response to the hardening of Chinese policy in recent years? When you look at how Australia is reacting to China, how would you characterise it?
As I mentioned in my speech here a few moments ago, the United States and Australia have extraordinarily complex relationship with China. We have deep deep economic engagements with China. They are certainly a factor in the relationship that we pursue, but I think it speaks extraordinarily ill of China and, you know, serves as a warning to all nations, the kind of economic retribution they take when they dislike another nation's diplomatic or security decisions, whether it's U.S. THAAD radar in Korea or whether it was Australia's debate over foreign investment laws within Australia itself. I think that serves as fair warning across the globe.
We're accustomed at institutes like the Lowy Institute to think about hard security challenges China poses. But at the moment, of course, the world is focused on the weakness of the Chinese system, or at least the terrible toll that the coronavirus is taking on China and the way that is spreading around the world. Do you think, I mean, should we be worried more about a strong China or a weak China, if you know what I mean?
Well, I spoke to that a little bit. I don't think it benefits the global security relationships or the global economy to have an extraordinarily unstable China. Not at all. And this is, you know, at the root of my comments. I think everybody hopes for a China that's participating in a global economy in a fair and transparent manner. And I highlighted some of the rule of law limitations that China has demonstrated, that if they would simply adhere to the rules, would be to the benefit of more of the globe. Certainly, the United States would stand in support of any request that China would make to come assist in the coronavirus. I'm certainly tracking its spread across the region, potentially. That includes the United States and North America. And would be ready to launch if we needed to provide any sort of support along the way.
All right, let me ask you...
And that extends to China as well.
Thank you. All right, let me come to Australia. And I know people in your position will often say, well, these are sovereign decisions for the Australian government, but sometimes we need some advice from good mates.
So statements and buts here, Michael. Thank you.
let me see if we can get some answers. Let me ask you about the Future Submarines Project in Australia. You may have seen that an Auditor General report came out recently which revealed that the government's Naval Shipbuilding Advisory Board was so concerned about the Future Subs project that it warned Defence it should consider walking away from that agreement. Every day there are stories about the Future Submarine Project. We know that even if it goes according to plan, the subs are not due to be fully operational until about 2035, and I think the last one is meant to enter service in 2050. How do you feel about this program? And is that, given the pace and scale of military modernisation in Asia, is that fast enough for us to get our new subs in the water?
Thanks, Michael, for that question. I appreciate it. I did speak to Admiral Noonan a bit yesterday, and he was in Washington last week to talk to our Chief of Naval Operations on the cooperative effort that we have in submarine development, and certainly in the combat system and the weapons that we have. We have a deep history on these things. I'll let Australia's challenges when it comes to shipbuilding. We have our own challenges when it comes to shipbuilding in the United States. I'll let them, you know, work this out. But I will say that the United States Navy, and I know this and received a note from the Chief of Naval Operations today, is willing to help in any way we can make this program successful.
What about sometimes there's speculation in the Australian media about the establishment of military bases by China in the Pacific? Is this, how real is this threat? Is this something we should be really worried about, do you think?
Well, I think the One Belt, One Road posture has been a stalking horse to advance Chinese security concerns. Minister Wei said as much in a Latin American conference just last summer. I think Australia has... need and right for every concern about the Chinese potentially building a base within the Pacific Island chain. And part of the Indo-Pacific strategy that the United States has put forward, and I believe Australia has made quite clear in their own national interest, is to prevent such activity from happening.
Let me ask you about some of the cyber attacks by state actors and indeed by China against institutions in Australia, against the parliament, against universities, against other Australian institutions. How should we think about those kinds of attacks? Are they acts of war? Are they sabotage? Is it espionage? Mm-hmm. How serious a problem is it? What should we do to harden our defences against those kinds of attacks?
One of the things, let me put it this way. Recently read a book, I must credit the author, David Sanger's The Perfect Weapon, right? Which I think most of the globe knows the individual stories that are in there, but it's essentially a 10-year narrative of what my own nation has been vulnerable to and what my own nation is capable of. And I think that stands as a sound narrative for people to think about when they think about their own vulnerabilities and the capabilities they might have for the future. One of the things that I think global norms should address when I talk about rules-based international order and the rule of law is to come together to talk about cyber norms. That's been lacking in the international environment. It has permitted some malign actors, either in a private sense or certainly in a state actor sense as well, to behave in areas that require illumination and then discussion about what expected responses should be. We need to spend more time on cyber norms, space norms in the international environment.
All right, my last question before I come to the audience. Would you like to see allies such as Australia invest in long-range strike capability? I mean, arguably, since we retired the F-111, we've lost a step there. Is that something you think Australia should think about?
I mean, I would, again, you know, leave Australia's decisions to Australia. But I'd say that the asymmetry that is developing in the region between malign actors like North Korea and China, and that asymmetry is this very large ballistic missile forces of varying ranges, is creating instability across the region and is leading to much of the concerns, not only in the security environment, but in the other environments I talked about earlier. It's estimated that some 95% of the Chinese weapon systems, had they been in the INF, would be non-INF compliant. We need to do more than defend ourselves from someone else shooting missiles at us. I say all the time, catching missiles with missiles is the hardest thing we do. There needs to be an effective offensive counter to act as a deterrent and drive the Indo-Pacific to a more stable environment.
It sounds like a pretty positive response. All right, let me go to the audience and give you an opportunity to ask questions. I saw this gentleman first in the... If you could just wait for a microphone, if you could tell us your name and any affiliation and then ask a short question. Thank you, sir.
Yep. Hi, Lincoln Parker from the Australian Defence Magazine. Thanks very much, Admiral. Outstanding speech, and thanks for being here. You mentioned United States going all in and... really looking forward a free and open Indo-Pacific. To that extent, your Navy has conducted probably more FONOPs over the past 3 years than we've seen in a very long time. So I think when we're looking at doubling down in the Indo-Pacific, would you consider deploying potentially an aircraft carrier, launching aircraft from within 12 nautical miles of, say, Fiery Cross, Mischief Reef and Subi Reef in a declared FONOP to further those aims?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk hypotheticals.
Yeah, questions,
I'm not going to talk hypotheticals about where the future might take us. I think it's important that the freedom of navigation operations that the United States conducts is not to challenge any one claim in the South China Sea, but it's actually about what amounts to three or four nation claims, depending on what set of islands that you're talking about. The United States has always run a very assertive freedom of navigation operation profile, and we have for decades. And we do it with everyone on the planet. This is not a U.S.-China issue. I would encourage all nations to feel that they have the freedoms to operate with what they've agreed to in the in UNCLOS, so that they're conducting their operations in accordance with international law and not feeling constrained by any of these claims. We like to say over and over, and there's reason for it. We will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows and in the regimes that international law has dictated. We'd encourage others to do so. We encourage others to be vocally supportive about our own efforts. And why I believe it's so important is because these claims and the freedom of navigation operations that the United States conducts are not a U.S.-China issue. They are a China international law and order issue. The more nations that operate in the South China Sea, the more nations that might operate conducting freedom of navigation operations, assert those international rights and properly frame what is an important international right issue in the South China Sea.
In the back row, and then Deborah. There's a microphone behind you, Richard.
Admiral, thank you very much.
If you could
Richard
tell us your
Bronowski,
name.
A retired diplomat, I was ambassador to Vietnam and to South Korea, and I was also DCM in Manila when Ferdinand E. Marcos was dictator and Imelda was buying lots of shoes. My question to you is, I think it was your third point when you said that you had a defence relationship with the Philippines. Well, I remember Subic Bay and Clark very well, and the American forces there, which were very strong. But hasn't Duterte just said, according to the Australian press today, that he's abolishing this treaty with the United States?
Yeah.
And where does that leave your grand strategy in the South Pacific? Thank you.
Yeah, he did not announce that he was abandoning the mutual defense treaty. What they sent was a notification of termination of our visiting forces agreement, which is indeed a key enabler for that mutual defense treaty. It's a 180-day notice. So we have some time for diplomatic efforts to be pursued here. To be fair, we don't have visiting forces agreements with all nations in the region, but our ability to help the Philippines in their counter-violent extremist fight in the south, our ability to train and operate within the Philippines and with Philippine armed forces would be challenged without that visiting forces agreement. I'll leave it there. I want to leave plenty of room for our State Department to do what you did in your career so well, and I hope we can get to a successful outcome here.
Thanks, Michael, and thank you, Admiral Davidson. I'm from the Sydney Morning Herald, Deborah Snow. You mentioned the terrible bushfires that this country has been ravaged by in your introduction. I just wanted to ask you, how is US Navy factoring climate change into its strategic thinking and its operational thinking? What kind of a challenge does that pose?
A couple of points. First, one of the challenges I did not mention here is, you know, the Indo-Pacific region is home to more natural disasters than any other region on the planet, right? Volcanic activity, earthquakes, it's all in excess of 75% of the globe's volcanoes are here, for example, along the Pacific Rim. Operationally, how we think about it, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, the joint headquarters, not just Navy forces, has a center for excellence in disaster management. It helps train my own uniformed forces, U.S. government officials, non-governmental organizations, but we also export a course that would train other nations, militaries, government officials, and non-government officials, including first responders, in, you know, command and control, sequencing of sustainment and logistics, how to handle a natural disaster like that. It's a organization that whenever I engage across the region, I make sure that other nations know that it's available to them, and we indeed export it around the globe. So at the operational level, it's one of the things we're doing immediately. Last year alone, United States military forces, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, we had on the ground for 6 months in Saipan and Tinian in the wake of a 500-year storm there to help remediate the damage that was there. So another operational obligation we have. I'll tell you, at the strategic level, when I travel the region, you know, most of the people I meet are about my age. And when I see my peers, particularly those in the Pacific Island chain, ministers, first responders, that kind of thing, first responder leaders, that kind of thing, I always ask them, can you see the effects of climate change in your own observations of your life here on the island, going back to when you were young? And they can all really articulate food patches, storms, changes along the shoreline, changes to their lifestyle as a result of the climate change over the last 60 years. It's a concern that we need to engage the Pacific Island chain nations with.
Can I ask you on that sort of topic, Admiral, if I just reflect on the bushfires, you mentioned that natural disasters happen all around the Indo-Pacific. But in Australia, we're used to our sort of external image being one of an incredible, a glorious environment, a beautiful climate. And I think a lot of the world was quite shocked by the coverage of the Australian bushfires. How much do you think that kind of thing affects the image of a country like Australia, given that our environment and our climate are so much a part of our identity, how we project our identity outwards? As a student of Australia and a global citizen, when you saw that, how much of a problem is that, do you think, for Australia? How much does climate change threaten to undermine, and our response to climate change, arguably, threaten our soft power around the world?
I won't speak to the challenges any of us have in that regard. But you know, I will say that many of the nations that we engage with bring this forward as a key security concern that they have. And it has to be something that I think we're willing to dialogue with them about.
Hi, I'm Aria. I come from, I'm after a one world, all right?
Very brief, yeah.
Okay. First question. I admire the Dwight Eisenhower. He concerned about country. Two things that are very important. One is welfare for American. Second is about military complex. Second question, I respect what you're doing. You got to do what your job, the best. I respect that. The third one, do you have any duty to tell your boss, Donald Trump, say isolationism is the wrong and we'll be alone and we'll be very dangerous for the world? Okay, thanks. Can you answer the third one for me?
So you've got a second to think about that, but the question is...
I didn't get any of them, so I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
The question was, do you have a response? You admire what the Admiral's doing. Does he have a responsibility to tell the Commander-in-Chief, Mr. Trump, about what?
What?
About isolationism.
It's really dangerous thing.
Okay. Okay. Well, why don't I give you... Okay, so how concerned are you about isolationism, about as a factor in world politics, and how do you report that up to your commander-in-chief and to your authorities in Washington?
Well, so, set the latter part aside. I mean, I talked about this. I think the strength of the rules-based international order over the last seven decades, and I think the strength going forward is in the alliances and strong partnerships that the United States has with others on the planet. And I would submit that Australia and Japan and others are as committed to that alliance structure as we are as well.
All right. We'll take a question from this gentleman, and then I think this gentleman had his hand up too. So, yes.
Tim Cole, the Papua New Defence. Admiral, where are we with grey zone operations, particularly in the South China Sea, particularly...
What kind of operations?
Grey zone operations. Particularly as regards countering China Coast Guard. You've got US Coast Guard cutters under your command. Are they there as a foil for China Coast Guard, or are they doing soft power maritime operations? Thank you.
Yeah, first, our United States Coast Guard generally does not operate under my authority. They do occasionally. When we're speaking to Chinese Coast Guard activities, are they involved in gray zone operations? I think that's the question you're asking. I think certainly the very complex set of organizations, Maritime Militia, Coast Guard, PLA Navy, and the single command and control mechanism that they have that oversees that helps facilitate gray zone operations. Certainly the activities around Natuna Island here over the course of the last 45 days or so was abetted by Chinese Maritime Militia, and I'm quite pleased with the Indonesian response to that. I think that the Indonesian response also sets a great example for the rest of the nations on the rim of the South China Sea to stand up for themselves in that environment.
All right, the last question is to the gentleman on the end.
Daniel from the Fiji Consulate here in Sydney, and thank you, Admiral, for your address, and thank you to Lowy Institute for hosting. So my question is actually in response to something that Michael wrote yesterday in The Atlantic, and he said that the world wants to believe in the US, but we need Americans' help to help us believe. So I wanted to ask you what we'd say to those of us who still believe in the US, who want to believe in the US, but somewhat feel disheartened, particularly with the events of the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those of us who may be losing faith in the US?
Well, I articulated much of the commitment here. And in my view, I don't think that has an expiration limit on it. And that's the way ahead for the United States and our relationships here in the region. So thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned earlier that the Pacific Command was rebadged the Indo-Pacific Command in 2018, and that was a reflection, I think, of the importance of this new Indo-Pacific strategic concept. And as the Admiral may know, a lot of the thinking behind that concept actually happened in this building at the Lowy Institute with my former and current colleague, Professor Rory Medcalf. And before I thank the Admiral, I just want to mention a quick ad that next month we'll be hosting the book launch of Rory's new book on the Indo-Pacific. So if this has whetted your appetite, we look forward to seeing you next month. In the meantime, I want to thank very sincerely Admiral Davidson for coming today. As I mentioned earlier, he has authority for a huge proportion of the Earth's surface. It's a lot of stress to bear. It's a lot of important issues that he has to deal with. He's been very generous in coming today, in giving very direct remarks, but also taking questions from me and from the audience for half an hour and for giving us actually very little filibustering. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming, and please thank the Indo-PACCOM Commander, Admiral Davidson.
Thank you.